This is James Hillman, 26 April 1989, Depth Aesthetics, tape 1 of 2.
Unlike yesterday, which was more of a formal talk, what I want to do this evening is try to move some thoughts, and we can do that by working together with it. The main thing really comes from yesterday. I said what Robert J. Lifton said was the trouble of our times was what we call psychic numbing, that we are anesthetized. And that being anesthetized means that maybe what depth psychology should be doing is resensitizing people, that is, lifting the anesthesia that we all suffer from. That is, we can't sit with the thoughts of nuclear problems, of the end of the world, of animal destructions, of all the various things for very long. We've anesthetized ourselves to so much. Or, putting it in another way, we are anesthetized to the worlds that we live in. We no longer realize that we're oppressed by our furniture, by the sounds, by the smells, by the world that's on us, that we prefer low-maintenance clothes, and even if they're ugly, but they're no bother. We want low-maintenance plants in our gardens. Things are sold that way, low-maintenance, meaning you don't have to touch them, you don't have to be involved with them, so that we can get on with our whatever it is. Unfortunately, it's getting on with our introversion, that is, our own internal life. This is a very big subject because, let me start with an example, a very simple example, so you see what I mean about my theme of the last 5 years has been the return of the soul to the world, or what used to be called in the Renaissance and earlier the anima mundi, the soul of the world. The soul of the world, anima mundi. And I've been concerned with getting the soul out of the consulting room and back into the world so that we don't think that soul is only inside our skin, only inside our analyses, only inside our therapeutic enclosures, but that it's also in everything. And when I was in Dallas for 6 years working at the Dallas Institute, or we had an institute there called the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture, our concern was with the city and how can we imagine the soul in architecture, in city planning, in transportation, in all kinds of things that we don't usually think of as having soul. We think that those things out there are, the soul is inside and out there is the world. And the world doesn't play a big role in usual thoughts about therapy. Now, I'll give you a little example. Let's say I'm on the highway in my little Hyundai or my little Yugo, and I'm driving along on the highway, and an 18-wheeler is right next to me, this massive thing. And I'm angry, and I'm afraid. So I'm on my way to my therapist. When I get into the therapist's office, I say, Jesus, I'm in terrible shape. I'm enraged with this son of a bitch and this giant truck next to me. I thought I'd be crushed. I'm afraid. So then we begin to talk. Now, there are all kinds of therapists. There are all kinds of conversations. There are many ways that this will be talked about. But let's imagine a sort of trite example that we then begin to talk about how I get shoved around and how my father used to be abusive and frighten the hell out of everybody in the family by coming home drunk. And we go on talking about a lot of things, about not being able to assert myself, and or that I have a lot of buried hostility, or that I'm very aggressive and that truck is really a part of myself because I have a lot of buried aggression. Whatever. We have begun to analyze very carefully my internal reactions, including my personal history, my family that happened 40 years ago, my father's dead, but still all of that about being shouldered and shoved around by him. We have not talked about the truck at all. At all. The truck was a trigger. Now, do you see what has already happened with that move? It has removed me as a citizen from my concern with the world and the fact that I've been outraged and insulted and I'm afraid by something in the world. And secondly, it has also emphasized the past. Now, as I say this, I don't mean that all therapy does this. I'm saying this is a general way therapy, as in theory, works. What actual therapists do may be many varieties and many variations on that. It has also emphasized childhood. By emphasizing childhood, it's constellated the archetypal child, and the archetypal child is a non-political being. So I'm depoliticized. I have become depoliticized in that conversation with my therapist. Been removed. Now, suppose interiority wasn't imagined only in terms of my personal history, but the differentiation of the emotion were differentiated in terms of my feelings in regard to the truck, then instead of being just outraged, I'd begin to be concerned about trucks and potholes, trucks and transporting lettuces from Southern California to New England, trucks and burning up all that fuel, trucks and the trucker unions and the corruption of the trucker unions and the problems there, the replacement of the truck highway system, the replacement of the railways through the highway systems. In other words, I would begin to differentiate the problem, the trigger that excited me, that enraged me, instead of only differentiating my own emotion, that is, my own history, the fact that I was shoved around by my father, etc. I begin to differentiate the interiority of the problem of that truck. Then I wouldn't be talking about my childhood, I'd be talking about the immediate phenomenal reality of what's been going on. I would no longer, I think, first of all, I'd be more political, I wouldn't be in the child archetype. Second of all, my emotion would be taken absolutely as information about the world, that emotions connect us to the world. The very word emotion means ex movere, moving out into the world, moving out, let's leave, not into the world, but moving out. So that the rage I feel would be taken up in terms of outrage prior to rage. See, we've internalized outrage into rage. We examine the rage, the hostility, but it starts off as outrage. That goddamn truck is overwhelming me. Now I'm outraged by this. We would take the fear that I feel as fear. Fear connects you to the world. If you didn't have fear, you could be dead very soon. All animals have fear. Fear is a necessary emotion to keep us alive. And instead of fear, therapy talks about anxiety usually. And anxiety, the difference between fear and anxiety by definition is usually that fear has an external object and anxiety is without an external object. So by talking about anxiety, we've already cut the world out. And we're dealing with our own anxieties in a Woody Allen fashion. Well, you know, feel anxious and so. And we've lost the truck again. So the emotion that would be talked about with a therapist would then have some connection to the original emotions as they appeared, the fear and the outrage. And we would be in a different kind of connection with the world. Now that's a very different view, and I haven't got this all worked out. I'm thinking that these are things that somehow we involved in therapy need to think about in some way, or involved in psychology, let's say that, involved in psychology need to think about. Because if we go on with the same system of psychology that we have had for the last 80 years, we have located the psyche, the interiority of the world, inside ourselves, or in interpersonal, it's either intra-subjective or interpersonal between two people, so you work on relationships and transference, or you can extend the intra to groups, so you have group therapy, but you never include desks, lights, ceilings, trucks, grass, tin cans, ashtrays, anything else. That's the non-psychological world. And I think that's Cartesianism. We're just going on with Descartes. We're saying that the psyche is inside and outside is dead matter, which is what Descartes said, which means that psychology is contributing to the split with the world, continuing Cartesianism, and not really healing the problem. It's leaving the world still. It creates the world out there as dead matter. It doesn't come into the therapy room. Do we talk about our beds and our chairs and our wallpaper or any of the things that we actually live with and that oppress us? The office you work in. The light in the office. The light in the office you work in. Not just the man who pushes you around and the relationship with him, which is the usual way of talking about the boss or whatever, but the physical environment. And if we don't think that that has soul in it in some way, as an American Indian would think that the trees that he's around and the rocks he's around and the springs he's around and the weather that he's around has soul in it. And this, so why don't we think all of this has not only affects our soul, but the soul in it might be improved by imagining it as part of the soul of the world. So we would think about things differently. We wouldn't think about things in the Cartesian way as just being dead and irrelevant to our psychic life. Now, what psychology's had to do with this for some years has been it's retreated into intensifying the internal subjective world, and you work on yourself so that you're, in a sense, immune to this. Or you go into Buddhist meditation or various techniques, and you become even more immune to it. And I think those things, those developments of immune systems are disastrous, because it leaves the world uglier and in worse shape than the patients themselves. We are much more sensitive than the world we live in now. That's gotten, in the last 80 years since Freud began and Jung shortly thereafter, as people have become much more psychically sensitive, but the world we live in has become more brutal and harsh and ugly and dangerous. And our emotions tell us this. Our emotions constantly tell us this. But psychology has perverted our emotions in a certain way by interiorizing them. So instead of talking about fear, we talk about anxiety. Instead of talking about outrage, we talk about rage and hostility. Instead of talking about desire, we talk about need. And that's the first level that I want to open up. I want to talk about it in another way. The truck was the first way. Second way, in regard to language. Let's say you take the bus. Now we get off. It's still on the roads. But now you get on the bus. Of course, the buses here are pretty good. And they don't seem to have a lot of people on them. And it's not a big thing. But let's imagine getting on the subway or the bus somewhere else. And I ask you, how was the bus ride? And you say, oh, it was awful. It was exhausting. It was miserable. It was, can't think, give me some more words like that. Exhausting, miserable, awful, frightful, so on and so forth. If there's more words, I can't get them now. Ah, now there's a difference there. Hot, dirty. That's different. Frustrating. Good, frustrating. Most of the language we use about our if I ask you about something, are subjective descriptions of yourself. They're not describing the bus. If you say hot, dirty, crowded, bumpy, you're talking about the bus ride. Most of what we say are frustrating, infuriating, exasperating, awful, miserable, frightening. Those are all descriptions of you and your emotion. There's a psychologization of external reality. So that we don't have the language about what's going on out there, we're talking about ourselves. We don't even recognize that. The bus ride wasn't frustrating. You were frustrated. The bus was hot. Or the driver was impertinent. Or you were shoved around. Or you got off at the wrong stop. Which is all a description of what is there. The language, our language, since the 18th century, it really doesn't start with just depth psychology. It starts later, earlier. Becomes more and more subjectivist. And the word self got attached more and more to words like self-conscious, self-realization, self-so-and-so. Those words with self in front, self and a hyphen, entered our vocabulary in the end of the 18th century mainly, and became more and more and more of that. So we tend to be talking more and more about ourselves and ignoring the world out there. Now, you can say, well, it's not the job of psychology to pay attention to that. The job of psychology is really to work on the neglected inner person. And if you want to deal with buses and you want to deal with trucks and highways and lettuce, and then you join political action groups. But I'm wondering about that division. And I'm wondering if you really can work on yourself without, as if you could split the soul of the individual off from the rest of the world. I think the theory, there's something wrong with that theory. The Platonists would say that the soul can't be located anywhere, it's everywhere. And you can't work on your soul without working on the world's soul. You can't work on the world's soul without working on your soul. So there are two, that's starting point, double starting point. The first was the truck, and the second was the bus ride, and a kind of critique of therapy as concentrating on the inner, where the inner is located inside the skin and inside personal relationships rather than inside things. That's topic number one. Now let's talk about this a little bit, because maybe I didn't make it as clear as I could have, or maybe you find it outrageous that this has nothing to do with psychology, or whatever you want to say about this. So please, yeah.
Well, the first hook that I got was that that would be, you can't really live without a vocation.
Without a vocation.
Would be that same movement, would be a good word for that same movement you're talking about addressing oneself and one's power and time.
You can't live without a vocation, without a calling of some kind.
Yeah.
Now, what's the next step of that?
It's the synonym that snapped into my mind with what you're talking about, of reaching out and touching and connecting, attaching to and contributing to the world.
Mm-hmm. So that we're called to do this. Are you suggesting that?
Mm-hmm.
That there's a kind of mm-hmm. call towards the world.
Yeah. Or from it.
Or from it. And maybe that's what we're beginning to experience now when we're concerned with the animals and the trees
mm-hmm.
and the waste and the pollution. We're beginning to feel that the soul of the world is hurting.
Mm-hmm.
Not just my soul is hurting. Or we're beginning to feel a community with that soul of the world.
I hope so.
I think many of us are feeling that.
There's a strange phenomenon of these Madonnas that weep, you know, in the media sometimes, and it seems, wherever or not it really happens, it galvanizes people's imagination. that there are these soul images that are weeping.
Yeah, Bill.
I like the idea of the outrage at the truck. When you internalize that, when you start psychologizing and looking at what shadow material that's coming from or what archetype that's coming from, what you're really saying is that that's a wrong feeling, that that's a distorted feeling. When you look at it from the point of view of the truck and outrage, you're validating the feeling as a true...
You're validating the feeling. You can also look at the...
It's okay to look at the outrage.
Yes. But we shouldn't forget the truck and just and not and simply call that as a trigger, because it goes back to trusting emotion as telling the truth about something, giving interest, indicating significance, or what Whitehead the philosopher said: emotion gives importance, and importance is probably the most important thing. As you walk through the world, everything's there. But only some things come at you as important. And what makes you recognize significance or importance is usually emotion. Yeah, please.
It's so interesting to me that you mentioned the truck, because today I had a real unusual experience. I went with my daughter-in-law to the Japanese garden, and I just connected. Now we were just coming from the Japanese garden. And it was very beautiful. And as we entered the Evergreen Bridge, you know, as you enter there. And there was a huge truck coming in. But it was simply beautiful. It was a, I sit here, look at that. It was sculptural. And it was stainless steel, and it caught the colors, the lavenders and pinks. And it really was very sculptural. And two parts, I thought, what is it carrying? And I looked, and it was gravel. It was a gravel. And I kept thinking, what beautiful truck? Because it was the only truck I've seen. And because I'm usually outraged at trucks on the freeway a lot.
So this was a parked truck just as... it was moving.
Yeah, it was moving, and we were trying to get in the lane. But it didn't see it. But it was me.
This is the story of the good truck. Yeah, and you evidently the garden helped you see the truck.
I found that as I was just sort of without my mind. Yeah. Although I do look a lot at, I have been thinking a lot about myself what you've been talking about for several years. Mm-hmm. But what I find difficult is nobody else. I mean, everybody around doesn't know what. I mean, they just don't feel the same thing about your state. And it's almost like I just might as well just go and, you know, escape from my apartment place or something, find another little place and sit.
Well, that question of noticing, I think most of us do notice or feel beauty. But there again, you see, psychotherapy doesn't involve beauty. The word beauty doesn't come in our theories. And yet nothing really moves us more. If you think about what has really moved you, what really does move you, whether it's music or a moment of beauty which makes you, you know, my heart leaps up when I behold a rainbow in the sky, you know, whatever, any way you want to put it, as tawdry and cheaply or whatever way, that moment of beauty is completely liberating and changing, and the soul lives on it. It's almost one of the ways you know you have soul. And yet, what does therapy do with that? Where is that in therapy?
Yeah.
What?
It's there.
It's there.
It's
there.
The beauty of an awareness.
The beauty of an awareness, yes.
The awareness, like, I think, feels very beautiful. Just
yes.
To know something that you now feels more real. You know, you've experienced something that widens your sense of reality.
So the word, it's probably the word that appears most as the most praiseworthy, the highest praiseworthy word we have. It was really beautiful. It was so, that's beautiful. There's hardly any word we can use that's more praiseworthy or powerful than that word, beauty or beautiful. I think that it may come in because, as I say, all kinds of therapists do all kinds of things. There are many varieties and variations. Theoretically, there's no mention of beauty in the when you study psychotherapy and you go through the training schools and so on and so on and so forth, there's no beauty doesn't come into the picture. And yet we all know that that's really what has a huge effect. It's a beauty that is referring to the beauty of invisibilities. Something to do with the movement of the soul that happens between two people. It's not the beauty of what you saw in the light on the shimmer of the truck, which is different.
There's often great beauty in the images, in the dreams.
Of course.
Yeah.
Can I get back to ugliness?
Sure.
Like in my therapy this winter, I had a fear in the world that remained subject for quite a while. Sort of like the fear of the truck or the great truck. Mine was around Savings and Loan Association. I had this fear that my bank was going to be put into receivership.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Overwhelming fear that that was going to happen. I had two therapists. I had a woman therapist who moved away. And
boy, if the SNL went down, you wouldn't be able to pay them.
That's right. I was unable to even discuss this problem with my male therapist. And I talk about it when I called up the balloon therapist. Mm-hmm. I kept for weeks. I would forget it throughout the life. And so she said, well, it's very simple. You just go to my bank.
Go on.
Talk to so-and-so. Tell them I sent you. Mm-hmm. It's the oldest established commercial bank in the state. If it goes down, everything's wiped out. And I was unable to do anything. And finally, I discussed it with my male therapist, and we related it to my father with my father. You know, I mean, when I was growing up, he would appropriate my savings. Figure out ways to do it. And once I had connected that, well, dealing with this problem was the same thing as dealing with my father in the present. It was the same thing. I did exactly well. I went to several branches of the same bank and got the highest quote. But eventually I was able to come to the best. Anyway, and I felt better about resolving my problem with my father at the same time. But anyway, that's all I'm going to say is that really, you know, you don't just talk about your father. You've got to do something about it. And the way you do something about it is dealing with these, you know, oppressive patriarchal things.
You weren't able to deal with the bank problem until you, in other words, it got stuck, so that you knew there was something else involved than merely changing banks or following the advice of the woman therapist. And that was an indication that there's more to this than merely a big truck or the SNL problem. You knew there was because of the stuckness of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there was a symptom involved, the fact that you couldn't deal with it just like that. Even if you studied the whole question of interest rates and the saving and loan thing, or the fact that they were guaranteed or that there was an FDIC behind it. I mean, no matter how much you went into it all, you still felt there was something you couldn't move your account or whatever it was you wanted to do. You couldn't take the action you wanted to do, so there was an awareness of a symptom. There was something symptomatic that was blocking you. See, I think that's where therapy is very important.
In other occasions, I will take action, but I'll do it precipitously. You know, I'm passive aggressive.
Well, you think you're doing it precipitously. Let's be careful about that. You know, we've all been psychologized to death. And so we think that when we make an action as a cat does when it jumps, or a squirrel when it jumps from one tree to another, which is a precipitous action, that if a human does it like that, that might be acting out. We have to be very careful about judging immediacy as acting out, as precipitous, as unreflected. Reflex action is the reflection and the action are going on at the same time. We tend to think, like Hamlet, that if we act, we don't reflect, and if we reflect, we don't act. We have to be careful that we haven't been psychologized in regard to that. So when somebody says, you know, precipitous action, I'm a little hesitant there, because it may be immediacy.
But it may not be rational.
So?
Like I once bought a computer because a team called me to go to radio chat. I took it back after a while.
Well, we don't know if the dream told you to go to Radio Shack. Your interpretation told you to go to Radio Shack.
Okay. I had a dream. No, I had a dream about Radio Shack.
It doesn't mean the dream told you to go to Radio Shack.
I went to Radio Shack, and then I had an impulse to buy a computer. Because I just wanted to hang out with the image.
Several years ago, I was talking about a woman artist who picks up trash and makes pictures from it.
And so ever since then, I live in the inner city and there's lots of trash. And I've been, you know, just trying to have this trash, you know, do something that's like a puzzle and trash. But still, just looks like trash to me.
Well, wait, let me get that one. Picking it up and doing, or you've been trying to change your eye the way you look at it? Yeah. Well, never mind whatever I was doing a couple of years ago. When you say it still looks like trash.
Yeah, I've been trying to just look at it and, you know, how it's sort of talking or
Mm-hmm. What kind of emotion do you have when you see the trash?
I don't like it.
You don't like it. Now, suppose we were to start with that. See, I mean, that's what I'm trying to start with. The ugliness was that you recoil from ugliness. And that's why ugliness makes the deeper mark, and why ugly images were used in order to shock the psyche. In The Art of Memory, and Plotinus writes about ugliness and so forth, that what it does, it makes the deeper mark, is the phrase they use, because it makes everything do this. Whereas beauty or makes one open up or go out. So your attempt, just as you said, her attempt then to transform the trash by thinking about it differently is still trying to do something to it with the ego. How did you put it?
The way you would put it, the waking ego, trying to
the waking
transform
ego.
Something that is really deeper.
Yeah, that is something that is really deeper. So it would be probably more important to recognize how threatened it is, how threatened you are by it, and how threatening it is, and how it's not just that you want to clean it up, but it is affecting you physically, makes you sick. Now, that leads to a whole set of realizations, too, of what's to be done about it. What do you do about it? It's too much for you to pick up. Do you write letters to anybody in the government? And I don't know. I mean, there's a whole set of, I'm not saying what the program is, but if one takes the threat, if one really begins to become sensitized to the threat, psychically sensitized to what's going on walking down the street, then something, actions of different kinds can come of that, rather than merely working on it internally. The working on it is recognizing what's happening to you. I mean, as we sit here right now, we have to shut out that sound. It's beautiful. Or we want to listen to it. It's a difficult thing to do, right? It's hard to do, is to let it come in. Yes.
The trash, too, then. I imagine you heard something that he said that sounded like a good idea. And so then one thing, I mean, what is the trash? I mean, it's like these guys are getting paid minimum wage and they're out after the boss is gone and they're taking stuff and they're throwing it up against the wall with their frustration, making a total mess. I mean, it's sort of like each element of, quote, trash, I mean, there's maybe a story
right.
about how it came to that state, you know. And the story may be an ugly story, in a sense, but, I mean, you could get into a way of appreciating how it has come to this state.
Yes.
Which then maybe could have some beauty to it or something, you know, or at least appreciation would go on, you know.
I was thinking of the different wounding that happens in trash. I mean, like compost is a lot different than the plastics I accumulate. I mean, one is a joy to behold. And when I'm sweeping up the gutter today with all the cigarette butts that my neighbors have thrown in the gutter, I'm really disgusted because I don't smoke. And I know those people are making themselves sick by smoking.
And you're happy that they are. Die. Die, die, die.
Yeah. On your trash.
Mm-hmm.
The trash is ugly, and you studied it, and no matter how hard you studied it, it stayed ugly. But as you told that story, I was picturing you studying the trash and feeling the ugliness, and that to me was beautiful. When you add you to that picture, and then, you know, if you were to pick up a piece of it or write to somebody, that would be even more beautiful, you know, or do something with it, yeah. But the beauty is in there.
Also, well, another step here, which has to do with victim. Today, victim's a big word. Everybody's a victim of something. Alcoholic parents who abused your uncle. You're a victim of this, or you were a victim of all kinds of victims. You're a victim of the trash. You're a victim of the trash as much as you're a victim of what happened to you when you were four. You're a victim of the truck as much as what happened to you when you were four. And if you can feel that, there would be as much rage around immediate victimization as there is today about past victimization. See, if we ask, basically, why are we so depoliticized in some strange way in the last 10, 15 years? It's not just blaming it on, you know, the media or the Reagan era or all that stuff. It's something to do with the displacement of our outrage to things that happened, that are not happening now, but happened long ago. And the trash feeling of living among this mess starts with sensitizing what it does to you. And then that's, as you say, that can move you into very different feelings. But I don't believe that you can just look at it differently and it'll change. Because this notion of mind over matter is too Buddhist for me.
I have a problem when you say that.
Yeah.
Because
I'm saying it to provoke, you realize.
Yeah, I sort of realize that. But you keep saying it.
Yeah. Well, I hadn't got a rise from anybody yet. And I'm
let the images come.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, there's problems I have with others. I mean, I don't even know what they have problems with it. I mean, the idea of sitting there and letting the images come is a big enough deal for me. It's a powerful experience to open me to more.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe the philosophy is the problematic area.
Well, letting the images come, but there's still some more. Besides letting the images come, see them, and let them pass through.
Mm-hmm.
Because then what's she going to do with that trash?
Mm-hmm.
See, then the world can be seen as the endless cycles of birth and decay, and the thing is to be, to get to some, you know, to get through the world's cycles. Rather than being passionately attached to the immediate problem. I'm sure it's different for. I usually am arguing with theories.
All those things are beautiful. You put them in museums and place them as the ideals in some cases. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, something's happened to them too. It's not just the trash truck picked up. It's also, first of all, it's in another place, so it's given another frame, and therefore it has another. But go on. I don't think we need. I think the question here is not to try and separate them. You're right, beauty and ugliness, so much as to reawaken the aesthetic sense. I'm more interested that she feels the depth of the shock of the trash on her system, on her physiological proprioception. Whether she gets that through beauty or through ugliness, it's an aesthetic awakening that's important. It's the aesthetic awakening. And that's, I think, that's what I'm...
Aren't you abstracting out from the world? Aren't you trying to give us into the world? Or something?
No, but if she is... if. No, because the aesthetic response is the response of the senses to the world. And that the word aesthetis meant originally the senses. That's all it meant was the senses. And particularly the senses as a... It was connected to a word for gasping, breathing in, that, in Greek. And that breathing in was a breathing in of the world. So your senses were taking in the world. It wasn't. It's what keeps one connected to the world. So awakening the aesthetic response keeps one connected. And in that sense, it doesn't matter whether it's a response to beauty. Japanese sense when they walk into a Japanese garden and they suck in through their teeth, that's supposedly a Japanese reaction to something beautiful, or whether it's the Greek gasp, or our sense of aha, not aha, but oh, those breathy reactions to the world. Well, in the garbage, or in the another way of looking at it is to imagine much more as a child, or as a person in a tribe somewhere. So, if you imagine that things are or can be animated, then you would talk to them. And does the ashtray like to have a cigarette stubbed out in it, or doesn't it? When you have a little child and you're walking down the street, and the child throws a piece of paper on the ground, and you say, pick that up. Why?
Well, you pick that up because if everybody threw the trash on the ground, the streets would be piled high with litter. We give those nice rational mother's answers to the kids or father's answers to the kids. Or you say to the kid, because I told you not to throw that on the ground, give the authoritarian answer. Or, you know, there are three or four of those kinds. But suppose you say to the child, pick it up, put it over there because that's where all the other paper is and it wants to be with its friends. Or that's where they like to be. They don't like to lie around in the gutter. They like to be inside that little basket. And you're talking animatedly then to the child, and the little piece of paper is an animated object, which has an intention. It likes to be here. It's a way of talking. So we still don't talk about, I mean, this little desk here, whether it really wants me to be this close to it or not, and so on. Does your house like you? Does your room, have you made your room so that it feels good when you leave it? Do you put things in it so that it likes to? Do the flowers like to be? People who put flowers in their houses have that feeling. They like to be over there. If it's a plant, it's much easier because the plant likes the morning sun. So you put it at that window, but you don't put it too close to the window because it doesn't want direct sun. And you speak of it animatedly. It doesn't want direct sun. It doesn't like to be too dry. But now you can begin to think of a lot of other things with that same kind of animation. Yeah.
James, just to argue for a moment.
Please, do.
It sounds like you've just discovered the feeling function.
Well, that's putting it all back into psychology again.
No.
Why not?
Well, I mean, that's the way I feel about a room.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of putting the paper with its friends, that's the way my heart works
mm-hmm.
all the time. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it worked before I was a psychiatrist then. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, it worked that way.
It's an animated... Well,
so it's like, I hear you talking about, yes, the Statue of Liberty is in New York Harbor.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for you, I see. Well, maybe, but if we think of it as the feeling function, we're not thinking about the paper, the little piece of paper and the little kid, with that animated way of... See, what I mean is that the feeling function or any psychological concept explains the, and that's okay. Let's say that's what it is, the feeling function. I'm not sure it is, but let's say it is. Doesn't that move, though, deprive us of the imagination of the thing being animated?
Labeling it would deprive it.
Doing it would not. Right. So the important thing would be imagining that way, imagining things as alive.
Yeah.
And they are. Well, now, usually we don't feel they're alive till they break down and don't do what they're supposed to do. And then you hit them, and you talk to them, and you curse them. Like, God damn, I've tried to fix that fucking toaster so many times, and that one side will not, it's all... And you get into an animated, a very animated dispute with this piece of whatever it is that doesn't function as it should, which means as a slave.
Now I'm seeing the animal movie. Now I can see the
movie. So you kick the car tire when it stops, and you do these things and do those things. But only in breakdown do we begin to notice the life, usually of a thing.
Anima gives life, so seeing the world as alive.
As alive,
is
exactly.
Anima.
Right.
Yes. Okay.
Right. Seeing it as alive, seeing it as having sort of intentions or qualities. That it, as Jung says, what crosses our path, the complexes cross our path, and that's what a god is, something that comes across your path and blocks your own intention.
It seems so we've been building and shaping the environment with this Cartesian split so deeply embedded, so that there's a soullessness incorporated into how we structure things. And so an aesthetic response to that would feel that soullessness of it.
First of all.
Yeah. Like downtown, and, you know, I mean, there's a soul there too, but so much of what we've constructed has been constructed out of this mindset of soullessness of things.
I think you're right. We, first of all, we try to eliminate as much soul as possible from what we construct, mm-hmm. or what we imagine to be soul. I mean, this is a difficult thing.
But isn't that when you work with the ideal, aren't you doing that? I mean, isn't somehow the, if you try to get back to some of the things you said last night, if the soul is sort of the message and then the ideal is more spirit.
I see.
And, you know, you talk about the trash and stuff. Don't you have some ideal where it's clean or it's perfect? And
the spirit sets up ideals of that sort, yes.
So you look at the trash and you have an emotional response and it's messy, but once you take it away, you're striving towards an ideal and does that take you away from your emotion somehow? You know, all of the buildings downtown, there's some construct or some abstraction that, to make that abstraction, doesn't that inherently have to move away from the soul to do that?
Well, if we think, yeah, I think that's very good. In other words, you're saying that a lot of the geometric and abstract forms that we use for construction are exemplars of a spirit approach, which is without shadow, without disturbance, without mess, without, yeah. So it creates an ideal which then only allows soul to appear in the mess.
And yeah, the disturbance or, you know, it,
as
or the social,
yeah.
It breaks down or something,
right.
It doesn't work.
Uh-huh.
Just parenthetically here, does mm-hmm. spirit, is it in love with predictability? Is that part of the neighborhood?
Probably. It's in love with predictability. That's a way of
that's
thinking about it, too.
Very much. Perfect.
Because that keeps things from getting out of order.
Yeah. That's what happens.
Order is a very important idea there. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the use of the whole square for construction, whether it's the square in building a room or the square, the 90-degree angle, which has dominated things to a fantastic extent. And you know that the word, it's an interesting thing, that the Greek word for a carpenter's square, the 90-degree angle instrument, is a norma, N-O-R-M-A, from which we have norm. A normal. An abnormal would be anything that deviates from that 90-degree angle. So you look around the room, there they are, they're 90-degree angles. Everything is put in that way. Our city plans are laid out in that way. So there is an ideal, and maybe not Seattle. There's an idealism in that, right. There's a spirit, that it is constructions a la spirit. It's not vernacular architecture. Or architecture that is associated with the directions of the, like Chinese, the way the north and the east and so on. All those kinds of things that have to do with the shape of the earth and so on and so forth. That's another, that would be a soul way of doing things.
I heard an artist describe design as having manners, art and guts. She was an artist that worked with designers.
Art? Art has guts and design has manners. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and guts are more messy, too. Mm-hmm.
Okay, yes?
Yeah, for quite some time I've been trying to remember where I heard the phrase that it is perhaps through us that the rocks know themselves.
I don't know that, no. Perhaps through us, it's that the rocks know themselves. I don't know that. I know a little story about a man driving in Japan with a Japanese driver, and they were out somewhere in North Japan in the country, and their car hit a rock and stopped. And they got out of the car, the Americans and the Japanese driver, and the Americans got down under the car and tried to see what had happened to the car, and the
The driver got out to see what had happened to the rock. Okay.
We're all here because we love this stuff and we want to take this journey with you. But frankly, who cares what happened to the rock?
All right, I mean, good.
And I have a feeling to say that is kind of...
No, that's good. Go with that. Go with it.
Well, I love to pretend that there's some soul in the rock, or that if my child draws a truck, she's soulifying the truck.
Mm-hmm.
And I can make art out of trash, and there's my soul in that art, but not in the truck, not in the trash, not in the rock.
Not in the rock.
Anyway, it makes any difference at all. The only part that counts is something internal that I do with that. There's much like that.
So you're God that ensouls things.
The best we got. Yeah. Best we got.
Okay, now then we have to think about how we define soul so that we have defined it in a way that it's not in rocks, trucks, and trash.
I want it to be in rocks, trucks, and trash.
Okay, now how can we...
simply having you tell me it's in the truck and having everybody go, ooh, I saw a truck today, it doesn't do it.
All right, how can we get it there? How can we get it there? Now, you suggested that we get it there by your child drawing it or you drawing it or something.
If she's got soul, I've got soul.
All God's soul. Children got soul. No, wait a minute. No, this is good. This is what this workshop should be doing, trying to work that one further. Let's stay with that.
Otherwise, I'll leave here and tell someone we talked about it, and they'll say, holy shit, you know, you spent
$50? All right. Well, we're going to work this. Go on. Yes?
Well, the one proverb from hell on Sunday that you read, before Michael, that caught me aslant, that I didn't know where to put, and I think it belongs right here with this business, was that the world is barren without the presence of man.
Yeah. Nature. Nature is barren without the presence of man. Right.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah. I just drew a blank.
Well, that's a radical thought if you live in the Northwest. Because the Northwest's notion of nature is that God's in nature. And anytime man comes around, he fucks it up. I mean, that's the romantic, that's not the Weyerhaeuser Timbers notion of, but it's the notion of the Sierra Club and the holiness of wilderness and so on. As if God only lives out there, he has nothing to do with the streets. So to say nature is barren without the presence of man or humans is much more the viewpoint. See, Blake was English, and that was the point of view of the romantics and landscape, which was that landscape was always connected with human beings in some way. A landscape meant there'd be a fence in it, or a house in it, or a barn, or a haystack, or church spire, so that the old landscape paintings always showed signs of something human in it.
So
landscape meant that originally.
The word barren doesn't mean barren. It doesn't mean that it's lifeless. It just means that it's manless.
Yeah. Well, it means that it has no history, and it has no mark, and in a sense has no real beauty. That it is the relation with the human that gives it its cultural richness.
But you're not talking about nature as being unbeautiful without men.
I think that's what they are talking about. I don't know what was around then. It's like that old thing, if a tree falls down, nobody hears it, did it make any noise? I don't know. Yes. But that isn't... No, that's very dangerous. If we blast ourselves off, the soul will still be there in the world.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Are you promulgating that or are you criticizing that?
I don't like it.
But it's true.
Now the danger with that thought is that we're just, you know, we don't have to do anything about things because life goes on even if everybody blows up. I don't think we want to get that. We got to get back to his question.
Can we animate the world? Can we animate the world? Without without having to accept the proposition that it is to us that the rocks know themselves?
Can you
get the soul into the world without having in fact handed it?
Can you get the soul back in the world without having, in fact, animated it?
Right.
Meaning, we animated.
Right. But if you can accept that we can do that, which I hope, my dearest, honest hope, we believe that we do. If we've done that, haven't we really done it? Then isn't the world truly animated? And don't the rocks know themselves to us?
Is it such a willful act?
Yeah.
It seems a paltry thing if I can animate it, you know, but if it's me that's it, it's paltry somehow. It's lost something.
It's paltry or poetry?
Paltry.
Paltry.
Yeah, it's a small thing, you know.
Well, see, we're starting off with the idea of deciding whether it's animated or... We've decided it's not animated. If we follow your point of view, what you were proposing, the rock, the truck, and what was the third thing, the trash... is just rock, truck, trash.
I like the view that it's animated. Yeah. It makes my life
beautiful. Trash, the so and so forth, is not animated. The rock's not animated. What are we saying when it's not animated? What do we mean? It has no interior life? It has no memory? What is it that it doesn't have?
That it can't move on its own, possibly.
Okay, can't move on its own.
But it does move on its own, like tectonics, you know.
Okay, so it does move on its own. Right. It moves so slow we don't see it moving. Okay. All right. What else? What else? What makes it non? I want to get that. What is it? You say first is that it doesn't move on its own. But then you've said yes, it does move. All right. So what else doesn't it do that keeps it from being animated?
It doesn't move me.
Its own meaning.
Create its own meaning. Aha. So it takes a human being to give it to. Recognize its meaning. Does it mean anything to the moss that grows on it? Does it mean anything to the water that comes down and has to divide as it goes around it? Does it mean anything to the skunk that pisses on it to leave a mark for another skunk? In other words, does that rock mean anything within its own world before you ever got there?
Oh, yeah.
That's an idea.
I feel like Morton Downey now.
Maybe the rock does, but the truck doesn't.
No, let's stay with the rock for a while. We'll get to the truck and the trash later.
That's what I was saying. Dinosaurs need the rock as much as we do, that's all. Or the cat or the tree on the mountain.
Right.
And the rock's way of seeing itself may be the tree or the mountain lion or the salmon that goes upstream or...
Okay, so they all have some kind of relation with each other. So the meaning of the rock is given by its world, not just by you coming upon it.
Well, it's back.
How about that?
It's back to like, this is, someone said the grace of God is sufficient to our condition as a fallen man. So the meaning, you know, comes from meaning. First, the meaning, psychological meaning, comes from what it does for me.
What it does for you,
yeah,
right.
Meaning that I could make them would have a chance of moving my soul.
Right.
And it is my soul being the one that moves the rock.
Well, I don't think that's true. I think the only time that it doesn't have meaning is when people don't have the patience or take the time to slow down and be with the rock or the plant or the water or the truck or whatever it is.
And
it takes patience and it takes time, and I think sometimes it takes an internal slowing down to hear its message, to hear what it is.
And just like with humans, very important. You can try and spend time with some human that you like, but that human may not like you, and the relation may never occur. So similarly, you can go with this wonderful intent to the rock to try to commune with it, but the rock may not be particularly fascinated with you and not show itself to you. But then another rock or something
else might.
Yeah, and
so
that's
just
why
saying
you're drawn
that rock
to different...
did not show its soul to me, then I draw the conclusion that rocks don't have souls, perhaps.
Right.
So that would be the wrong
word. Good point. That's very important. And there's another little thing. Sardello, who was a friend in Dallas and spent a lot of time writing about these things, says the language of things is very difficult for us to understand because it's a language of silence.
I mean, it all has energy.
Now, that you may think that's too cute, but I think he's saying something important there. What?
That's
yeah.
Last night, you know, with a couple of words speak against each other, and, you know, for years without seeing the inadequacy of our language, the words just aren't there to describe the truck that she saw. Just communicate in dialogue is fine. But when you want to speak of this moment of this beautiful experience that you've had, the words aren't there. And of course, you alluded to, you know, let's go back to Longhand and things. But of course, we are moving into the age of the computer where hopefully, I do feel someday, my thought image will be able to be projected and I will not have to speak the words to say it. And I like to watch the garbage truck. I spend time watching the truck pick up my garbage. And when I sit on the rock, I personalize it. And just as a snail leaves the little aka threads, pulling our daily trips to my garbage. The man has nicely taken away my garbage, and I don't have to deal with it. And I go out and sit upon my favorite rock. And I'm sure it's like a web that my soul and the soul of all of these things are interconnected. Of course, the garbage decomposes, breaks down, and gives new life. And I don't need to go on and on. But because we all just live in our own little personal world, we're, of course, all going to make our own experience so personal in our own space. And yet, I just sort of feel the oneness of my garbage with the universe and my rock with the universe.
Now, the couple things that we do, you see, you go and sit on your rock, you say, so to speak. Part of what makes the car come alive for the Hispanics who live in Santa Fe, or for people in certain parts of the world who deal with cars, is they take them apart and do things to them. They paint them pale pink, or they do this, or they do that. They take the bumpers and put them on upside down so that they've done something else. And the car has changed, has become more animated, because they put their hands into the car in some way. Now, in societies which have idols and statues and stones and little figures and so on, they don't just have idols and statues and stones and things. They do things to them to keep those gods alive by rubbing them with oil, by putting flowers around them, by bringing little pebbles to them, by making a dance or a chant. It's not just this tree or this statue or this. So that the statue that we take then from the Congo or from Gabon or something and bring back and put into a museum of African art, for the people who live in that tribe, that thing is dead. It's entombed in a glass coffin. It's not a living thing because it's not being oiled, it's not being sung to, it's not being danced, it's lost its effects, its effectiveness, and it's not animated anymore. So the application of the hand to things, that's why I started off by talking about low maintenance. That part of the way we kill the world or deanimate the world is with low maintenance, by keeping our hands off. And the more we put our hands on the world, it seems to me, the more possibly we are recognizing the, or we are animating, or we are recognizing the animation of it or something. I don't like the idea that I'm animating it, or I'm deanimating it, but somehow there is some, I'm in some kind of physical relationship to it. So that I'm speaking the language of silence with the things then.
As you were talking about what people in maybe more primitive cultures, like what they do with rocks and put oil on it or make something out of it, whatever, you...
Well, they may move the rock from here to there.
But what I want to say is the way you describe that is that people are doing something to the object. And I don't think that that's necessarily what happens in those cultures. I think what happens is there's a dialogue.
Yes, sure.
There's a dialogue. And it's as if the rock asks to have the oil put on it and people respond to that. And so that there's a dialogue and a relationship.
Yeah, and if asked, why are you oiling the rock? They'll tell a story about a creation myth
about how somebody, if you know, the jaguar came out of the forest and da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and he did, brought the coconut, so we oiled it, we've been oiling it ever since, or something like that. As if there was an instruction given by something, a spirit, a rock, a demon.
In fact, there was.
Yeah. In fact, there was. I don't talk facts. I don't know any facts. But okay. That's the story they will tell. Lovely poem. There's a phrase in a poem, one that Robert Bly quotes all the time. It's a New York poet. What the hell is his name? Who? No, no, it's just a line. To be able to look at a mountain and not think it means me. When can I look at a mountain and not think it means me? See, that would not be the animation, thinking it means you. You know, personalizing is not the same thing. It's not the same thing. Now, has anything moved for you yet, or can you fight this thing a little further?
I need to go further.
Good.
Please do. I'm discouraged to think that the only way we can get all of us human beings to stop ravaging this planet is to get enough people to believe that the rocks have souls. I think that's not likely.
You think that's not likely?
I love that belief, but I think, well, that won't do it.
That's already talking back to me.
Anyway, perhaps get people to believe that they ought to leave the rocks for their children and their souls. But still, it doesn't.
That would be one way to let people. Let me hear that one again. That's interesting.
We can go easier on the rocks because, and the trees and the forests and mm-hmm. the trash or whatever. Because we want to leave the planet for our children who have souls. And I could convince more people in political work that that's a good motive for being gentle on the planet. I don't think I could convince them that they ought to be nice to the rocks because the rocks have souls.
But trees will grow again, and there will be more rocks there.
Well, that's good.
So what is the need then? Why do we have to care here? Why do we have to watch out for the planet?
That's one of the basic arguments, isn't it? Nature's been around for thousands of years. Mother Nature will take care of us.
But it's clear that we have enough force to wipe it out.
Sure, I think that's clear. Besides, I think Mother Nature has Alzheimer's now. I think we have to take care of nature completely. She doesn't take care of us. She can't handle the ozone problem. She can't handle the seas. She can't handle any of the stuff we've dumped on her. She's sick. And we have to take care of her. The national parks have to be taken care of, the wilderness, everything has to be taken care of. The trees are dying from acid rain, in the east the lakes are dying, the fish are dying, so on and so forth. We have to keep doing things. It doesn't, Mother Nature, the fantasy that Mother Nature takes care of us isn't so anymore.
But the fantasy is that it doesn't involve not with whether nature's being taken care of, but whether men are being taken care of. When we take care of men will see the soul in the rocks. They will see the soul in the rocks.
When what happens? No, I don't get that. I don't get that. Psychotherapy's been taking care of man for the last 80 years, and they still don't see soul in the rocks.
I'm not so sure psychotherapy has been taking care of man.
Absolutely not.
I wouldn't buy that.
Has anything been taking care of man? Humans. Let's not call them... Since Freud came on the scene, if we would only get the architects into analysis, we'd have better buildings. If we got politicians into analysis, we'd have better politics. If we got school teachers into analysis, we'd have better education. And we've been doing that for 80 years, and I don't think that's worked. We don't have better buildings, we don't have better education, and we don't have better politics. And we've worked very long and very hard at getting everybody into analysis. I think if we wanted to have better buildings, we have to have better buildings, and we're not going to do it by analyzing architects. So I don't go with that one. If you want to push that further, go ahead. But
well, I don't think you have.
I mean, it's not just what happens in the world is not just a projection of an inner process. It has something to do with with that world there, and our feeling and our sensation and our intuition and our thinking in regard to the world.
So conversely, a better environment may not make better people.
A better environment, will it make better people? I'm not even thinking about making better people, really.
Well, I mean, it's like
or making better is
it?
Yeah. No, it has more to do with my emotion than it does with my utopic feelings. I'm thinking much more about my outrage and my sadness, tremendous sadness about dead trees and apples that aren't real, that they're all shiny, Washington State apples. And so many things that all seem that make me sad. There's a lot of grief about things. It's not that it should be better or man should be happy. I don't have any kind of utopic thing. It's much more emotional reactions to what is. Fear, anger, grief, shame.